Hello and welcome to a new episode of The Quill. Today, well, as you can tell from the title, we're talking about the end of the war and well, it's gonna be quite interesting in my opinion because it will set up the end of these lovely season that we had, where we learned a lot, we basically lived through the horrors of being bombed and not knowing how to survive in a world where things just change too quickly, and the mental scarring of John were absolutely terrifying. So, well, last time we finished the war in Europe, basically, but, you know, we really didn't go too much into detail as we tried to basically just put Romania into perspective and what was happening at that time, you know, which is rather unfortunate. But now we're gonna talk about, well, the end of the war, where the Allies were, where the Russians were, what the Russians wanted, and how they were gonna set up the Iron Curtain. Of course, we're gonna kind of dive deep into the curtain, see the countries, analyze a bit this and that. I'm gonna show you, I have a few videos, of course, prepared as usual if you're watching live or if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening to us, thank you very much. But yeah, let's get into the last months of the war. Hitler basically lost drastically by 1944, by the end, by spring of 1945, it was all but done, as you can see on this lovely map here. Even after they pushed back in Hungary, or tried to push back in Hungary and tried to push back in France, they failed miserably. But you know, they failed because, well, the generals and Hitler himself wasn't quite clear minded at this point in time, and you know, the Russians were throwing millions upon millions of bodies at the problem, with the total army pushing back against the Nazis and pushing into Germany was around 2.5 million people. And in my opinion, 2.5 million people is a lot of bodies to throw around and to throw at a problem and to rush basically to get to Berlin so they could end the war and so Stalin could set up his little Iron Curtain around all these countries. So it was quite fascinating, though terrifying, since Russia was one of those countries that, you know, sacrificed the most, but they sacrificed it willingly, unlike, of course, the Jewish population or the Polish population, which were, you know, by now we all know the atrocities, and I don't think we should really stick to them and talk about them. But with that said, of course, last time we also mentioned that Russia wanted quite a big part of Europe so they could protect themselves and basically, you know, have the force to fight anyone at any time without any major repercussions. So that's exactly what Stalin did by quickly pushing communist governments in Ukraine, Poland, Romania, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, and so on and so forth. But until they got there, they had to get to Berlin. And getting to Berlin was kind of tough because the Germans were still very strong here in these three positions, and they were cut off here in the very north, which this is where that army stayed until the end of the war, which is quite fascinating in my opinion, cutting a big section of an army on a peninsula like that and holding them basically hostage and removed from the war. So basically from the south we had the US and the UK coming and bombing Russia here from Budapest, pushing also in the south and central. They were also coming from this region, pushing central, and they weren't really giving a damn because by now Germany didn't have the resources it used to have, since most of its oil was coming from Hungary and Romania. So with two-thirds of oil gone, they couldn't stand a chance. And for example, here in the south by Croatia, this little F section was quickly defeated in like 2 weeks. And on the other side, the British and the French quickly fought back and deterred any offensive the Germans might have had, one last stand trying to, you know, regain some territory and regain some resources, which they failed. So with the Russians pushing in, with you know, the Allies basically surrounding Germany, by 1945, by March, it was all but done. But Berlin wouldn't fall this easily. You can see it here. Berlin was a terrible, terrible place to fight, both for Russians and for Germans, as Germans lost over 800,000 people there, civilians and army, and the Russians couldn't care less, so they throw bodies upon bodies to kind of massacre and fight to finally take over Berlin and finish the war in Europe. So with that said, let me show you a beautiful video of exactly that happening, of Russians getting to Berlin here, and it was absolutely decimated. They absolutely destroyed every piece of that city, and I'm honestly in awe of the fact that there are still places that are still standing from this attack of the Russians. And it's really, really interesting to see this massacre, but at the same time, for me at least, it's really, really fascinating seeing war actually documented, because most of the time war and atrocities are quickly but easily hidden from the eyes of the populace. But in this case, since the Russians were victors and the Allies were victors, obviously they couldn't care less. Another fascinating thing was that this meant a lot for Stalin and Russians. As I said, they were trying to rush and get to Berlin first and finish Berlin first before any of the Allies could get here, because It meant that they could push a bit further and ask a bit more and, you know, have that prestigious crown of we finished off the Nazis and we won the war in Europe, which is exactly what happened. By the time the Allies got to the south and east of Germany, Russia was well in, you know, Berlin and fighting, and here you have the flag put up on Berlin, which is truly, truly fascinating. And basically victory declared for the Allies, and the Nazis were no more. But of course this didn't mean the end of the war. The war still had some way to go, which is truly fascinating and horrible at the same time. But here you can see the end of any and all Nazi Germany and the war in Europe. Though the number of people that died, though the horrifying effects of what happened in those years can still be seen today and still be felt today, where you have people like Putin, where you have, you know, Nazis, and these buildings, many of these buildings were refurbished or rebuilt, and you can actually go in Berlin and look at these buildings and be like, this is where it all happened. It's truly, truly amazing. For example, I visited Budapest, and Budapest still has some of the same old buildings that were filled with bullet holes and were rebuilt after World War II and refurbished, and it's absolutely goddamn amazing to walk those streets and know that there were bullets shot at those buildings and people died there fighting Nazis, and Nazis fighting Romanians and Russians and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's something to kind of watch this and not be astounded by the history here and what was happening and what this meant next for Europe and the world economies, because I don't think you can discount one for the other, as it really had a giant impact. And due to all this, it also meant that, well, we got a lot of positive things out of one of the most horrific wars that we had ever had to face as humans. So it was truly, truly something. And the fact that they pushed, you know, Hitler to commit suicide, the fact that, you know, 9 day was, the 9th of May was Victory Day in Europe, it was truly, truly fascinating. And I'm looking here at this timeline, and timeline of World War II, and sometimes you really can't understand why some things happened or how they happened, it's truly, truly, absolutely fascinating. And I still can't comprehend how fast these months in 1945 moved. So they, you know, just had this quick boom impact. And honestly, so let's continue with that. So after the victory day, May 8th, 1945, of course Himmler commits suicide on May 23rd, and of course, you know, here the diplomatic and really, really interesting stuff started to happen, because you had all these mechanical little parts moving and shaping the world. In some parts, for example, it did nothing but create more chaos, like the Middle East and Africa, and of course South America. And in other places, it consolidated power. For example, in the US, it helped the UK regain some of its boom, and things started to kind of move in a weird way. So let's kind of get into it. As you know, the United Nations Charter is signed in San Francisco, and well, we have a few things happening. And after Berlin was basically decimated and the war ended, let's watch another lovely video with Berlin just a month later. So this is the capital of Berlin, right? A month later, after the bombing and after the war had ended, maybe 2-3 weeks since the war ended. So it's just fascinating to see. Look at this building, at its giant hole in it, from what I assume was a cannon or a missile or something that was fired at it. And you see there, there was this very interesting sign there on the column reading, "You are now leaving the British sector," and on the other side there's that giant picture of Stalin, obviously, and the Russian sector. So they already had divided Berlin into its sweet little sectors, and well, we all know what came next. But yeah, there you have it. This is the Russian side of Berlin right after, well, the war ended in Europe. And it's, I don't know how they thought this through, why, how they came to this compromise, where they thought this would make sense, why it would make sense. It's truly and absolutely fascinating, in my opinion. The logic behind all these little moves and all these things that were happening, with or without, you know, thoughts, are absolutely fascinating. Imagine splitting a capital and then a country. So you could fly, for example, in West Berlin if you were an allied, but you were still surrounded by what was the East Berlin and East Germany. So I don't know how they thought it through and why. It just absolutely blows my mind, honestly. It's fascinating, but it's also cruel, the way they built that wall afterwards, and the way they kind of thought this process through. And it feels like it was exhaustion. It feels like they couldn't keep fighting, for example, Russia. They wouldn't want to keep fighting Russia because they were exhausted, and fighting Russia, if they were to continue to fight Russia, would have meant a giant risk of continuing this war for like 10 more years, or who knows what the outcome would have been, because Stalin would have just chucked body after body after body after body at the problem. Romanian, Hungarian, Czechoslovakian, Polish, Yugoslavian, body after body after body. It's truly fascinating, in my opinion, that somehow they thought it and they didn't think it properly through. At least this is how it feels, standing back now, so many years removed from the war, and it's just absolutely terrifyingly interesting, in my opinion, because you shape the world like billions upon billions of people were shaped by this war, and you were splitting a whole continent, and then some, because Russia is giant, into two pieces. And Jesus Christ, it's just, it was like a pissing contest, but, or at least that's what happened after World War II. It was like a pissing contest from two sides, but it's truly mind-boggling, in my opinion, especially the Cold War era and everything that happened after the war ended here in Europe, because the war didn't end in the Pacific. Japan was very much aggressive, continuously trying to expand. At a few points, Japan was threatening Australia, for example, and New Zealand. So they were trying to push and, you know, conquer more and more of China, and then push into India and that part, which is again a very terrifying thought, honestly, if they had succeeded. But now that basically Germany was out, because they were out, Japan had no real allies to feed them oil, to feed them steel, to feed them anything, any kind of technology to keep it going and keep the war going. So it's well, we all know what came next, but the thing is that Japan didn't just get those nukes because they wanted to test on them. Raising cities was a thing before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They raised many cities that way all throughout Europe and the world during World War II, and in Japan too. They had done this, but, you know, Japan still didn't surrender even after that, which is, you know, terrifying, honestly. And considering the fact that they had this giant, let's see if I can find a proper map of it. Because they weren't small at all. They were really, really big. And here we have one really interesting picture. Yeah, perfect. With the height of expansion of Japan in 1942. So this was Japan in 1942. Now imagine that Japan was close to Alaska. Japan wanted to push into Mongolia, into the rest of China, and you know, they already had this part here and were and a bit of India, so why wouldn't they push further in the mainland of Asia, right? Since they had Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Nanking. So you can imagine that they were an empire, a true empire. No matter what you think, this is an empire. And of course, just because Germany lost, that didn't mean shit to them, because Japan was strong in air battles and on sea, obviously, and they were really well defended. And considering that the fact that, you know, Japan beat the Soviet Union multiple times here, they weren't really afraid of Russia. They had no reason to be afraid of Russia. And why would they be afraid of Americans? They've been fighting Americans since Pearl Harbor, and look at this, 1942, they had this massive chunk, and it took a while. And the reason the Americans used the bomb was because it was effective. It sent a message. It was something to fear, and it was something that no one knew how it would affect the world, right? So with that said, let's get into this sweet little video from the Telegraph with the Hiroshima bombing, which honestly is, it's just haunting to know that thousands upon thousands of people died. It's truly something, honestly. Oh yeah, this little building here. This building here, if you're watching on Twitch or on YouTube, this building, you can still find it if you go in Hiroshima by the river. There's this what looks like a rundown building in Hiroshima with that metallic dome. You can still find it today exactly as it was back then. Of course, they cleaned around. But it's a reminder of what happened in 1945, and the fact that the Japanese at least had the courage to keep this is truly mind-blowing, because of course, as many of us know, people tend to be absolute cowards and hide their shame. But it's, so this is what an atomic bomb, and the bombs we have now are far more dangerous and far more powerful than any of this. And You can look at the effect it had on people. Those scars, those burns, that toxic radiation is something else. And here we have the bombing of Nagasaki, and we luckily also have from BBC some bits of narration, so hopefully.
3 days after the Hiroshima bomb, despite all the destruction, Japan still hadn't surrendered. A second bomb was made ready, and Truman issued another warning.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on war industries. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor.
Oh my God, that speech is really well written and really, really haunting, honestly. If you try to put it in that context.
Those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war. Against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war. In order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
The second bomb was intended for the city of Kokura, but it was too cloudy, so the plane moved on to Nagasaki. Desperately short of fuel, the crew released the bomb despite more clouds. The bomb missed the aiming point and fell into a valley. This time there was no firestorm, but even so, more than 50,000 people were killed. The Supreme War Direction Council in Tokyo was meeting on the same day. By now, the Russians had declared war on Japan. Then came the news from Nagasaki.
天皇の国宝上の地位を変更しないことのみを条件としたい。私も同意見だよ。すぐにでもアメリカに連絡を取って。Oh,
yeah. I forgot that they do reenactments and. For those that don't know Japanese and are listening to the audio version, I'm gonna
meeting on the
give
same
you,
day. By now, the Russians had declared war on Japan.
I don't know Japanese that well. Let me preface this: it's just that they have subtitles.
Then came the news from Nagasaki.
天皇の国宝上の地 There is only one thing we need to establish, and that is the survival of the emperor system.
地位を変更しないことのみを条件としたい。私も同意見だよ。I agree.
すぐにでもアメリカに連絡を取って。We should contact the Americans immediately and make plans, make plain our position.
我々の真意を明らかにしなければならないね。待て、事態は何?
Nothing has changed. We must insist on the terms we all list. Thought necessary. So this is what I was saying before, where the Japanese didn't really have to fear anyone because they were beating China to a pulp, and India and Russia, and they were in a stalemate with the Americans. So who exactly was a threat to them, you know? The empire system must survive. The Americans cannot occupy the home island. Nor can they try to so-called war criminals. We will be allowed to manage the disarming of the navy and army ourselves. But they will never accept these terms.
決裂したらどうするのか。
最後の一戦を交える。
Then they will risk the cost of invasion. See, they. Now we have over 3 million soldiers ready to fight. And 500,000 planes to attack their troops off the coast of Kyushu. We can even use our training aircraft as specialized kamikaze attack planes. They will wary of the slaughter. If we expand our forces, fighting the first assault will be completely helpless. So again, the Japanese didn't give really a shit about what was about to happen, even after
Nagasaki.
Two atom bombs in 4 days, two whole cities obliterated. Then next may fall on Tokyo. We must wait for the result of our investigations before we can be certain they are atomic bombs. Bomb on Tokyo could destroy the imperial family. There would be panic on the streets. It's unthinkable. A true soldier would rather die than surrender.
Then Prime Minister Suzuki did something unheard of. He asked the Emperor to break the deadlock and make a decision. Emperor Hirohito told them he wanted to end the suffering and bear the unbearable. 4 days later, radical soldiers attempted a coup to prevent the surrender. They failed. At dawn, on the day that Emperor Hirohito was to broadcast an announcement to the Japanese people that the war was over, General Anami prepared to end his life in the time-honored tradition of seppuku. His suicide note read, "My death is my apology for my great crime."
And there you have it. This is kind of what happened at the end of World War II and ending World War II, actually, which is rather interesting and both terrifying in my opinion, because a lot of people died, and you know, it's, I can't really understand why or how this was allowed to happen for so long, but it's terrifying, because for example here you have fractions of various countries' population that died in World War II, and you have Belarus with 2.29 million people, you have Poland with 5.82, Ukraine 6.85. Now you put Ukraine, Belarus and the rest of USSR, which is 16.825 million, together, and it's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing how many people they just killed off, and they didn't give a shit. Latvia, 260,000, Lithuania, 375,000, Germany, 9 million, Japan, 3,120,000, China, 20 million, China, 20 million, just like that. And those 20 million that died fighting Japanese. So, if you're also wondering if Japan deserved two atom bombs, you should look at that 20 million killed there. because that's basically it. Then you had France with 550,000 people, Italy with 454,600 people, UK with 45,900, Canada with 100,000. I meant to say 100,000 to France, Italy, and United Kingdom. If I didn't, 45,400 to Canada and 4,200,000 to the US. And that's kind of just a small part of it, because well, here we have another little graph that basically puts them into percentage. So out of the total population of that was in 1939 in these countries, this was the percentage of people that died. USA 0.3%, so 400,000 people. Norway 0.3, so 10,000. Canada 38,000, again 0.3. Bulgaria 20,000, 0.3. Australia 29,000, 0.4. Italy 303,000, 0.7. United Kingdom 386,000, 0.8. These are kind of estimates. Soviet Union includes also the Baltic states. Philippines 118,000, so 0.9%. It's with 1.1% and 88,000 people. Belgium, Japan 1.8 million, so 1.8% of the people. Romania with 1.9 and 378,000 Romanians, which is a lot. So Romania lost a lot during the war, especially if you look at percentages compared to for example Bulgaria and other countries, in some of the other countries in that same region. But then again, you have, you know, France with 1.9 and 800,000 people, Finland 84,000 people, Netherlands 100,000 people, 15 million in China, so 3.5 there. Hungary 40,000, 4.57. Greece again 406%. Germany 7 million, 8.8. Yugoslavia 1.7, so 11%. Soviet Union 25 million, 14.2%, and Poland 6 million, 17.2% of their population. And honestly, that's absolutely horrifying. And to think that this was fought due to some reason, some so stupid reason, honestly, because I can't describe it any other way. And well, thus concludes World War II. October 24, 1945, the United Nations is born. November 20th, Nuremberg trials begin. And here we are, at the end of World War II. Now we have an Iron Curtain. A curtain that split Germany into two pieces. A curtain that allowed Stalin and the Communist Party to kill a bunch more people after the war, because they were fiends, they were against the system, they were bad people, they were Nazis or allied, you know, or other type of sympathizers which they didn't agree with, even in countries like Romania, where they were, you know, a kingdom, and they really couldn't give a crap about communists until, well, World War II, until the communists made their way in. So this is the Iron Curtain. You have NATO states with Norway, UK, Iceland, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, West Germany, Italy, France, Luxembourg, Portugal, Turkey, and Greece. Then you have those that were non-aligned, like Finland, Sweden, though again, Finland was a participant in the war, Ireland, Spain, Austria, Switzerland, and the list goes on. But we're our main focus is here in Europe. Then you have other communist states. So we talked about this a few times now, about Yugoslavia and Albania, where, well, you know, the curtain Stalin had in mind was from Hungary, you know, down to Yugoslavia and Albania here, so they could push up to, you know, the NATO states like Greece and Turkey. So they would kind of have these states here in the south, east, isolated from the rest of Europe, kind of, except Greece here, kind of being close to, you know, Italy. But even so, I don't think that would have been a problem for Stalin, and I think he would have been very pleased. But to the very, very, very complicated history and ethnicity problems and all those problems, the communists didn't really, Stalin specifically, didn't really get to have his way with Yugoslavia and Albania, because it was very, very weird. So you have it here as East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland afterwards, and of course the USSR having the rest. That was the Iron Curtain, and boy, was it a weird one. Because even though the communists had made their way into, you know, most of these countries by the end of 1945, they weren't really established that well, even though they were pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, they wouldn't really have their way for a long time. But we're gonna discover that with the next season of The Quill. And here is kind of where we're gonna end today's episode, because all I really wanted is to get to the end of 1945 here and show you where we are now. Because this is how they chose to split with the Yalta Accords, you know, Europe. Then we're gonna have 1946, we're gonna have some effects of the trials and some executions and a really bunch of complicated stuff happening both in Romania and Europe. But with that said, I really appreciate your view, I really appreciate you watching or listening. Until then, see you next time, and just take care, because, yeah.
So long as the